This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Linda Mapes, staff reporter for the Seattle Times, where she specializes in coverage of Native American tribes, nature, and environmental topics. Linda has received many national and regional awards for her work. Along with her teammates at the Seattle Times, she shared the 2012 award for online journalism from the American Association for the Advancement of Science for coverage of the removal of Elwha River dams in Washington State's Olympic Peninsula and efforts to restore the Elwha ecosystem. Linda also has been selected as a Knight Science Journalism Fellow in Residence at MIT for the 2013-14 academic year. Linda Mapes is here today to give us an update on the Elwha and to tell us about her book, Elwha, A River Reborn, published in 2013, with photography by Steve Ringman. Welcome, Linda. Great to have you back.
Good morning, Diane. It's great to be back.
Would you remind us of the Elwha ecosystem and what it was like before the Elwha and Clients Canyon dams were built on the Elwha River?
Well, the Elwha is a magnificent river. It runs for 45 miles, headed north, actually, to the Strait of Juan de Fuca from the Olympic Mountains. And most of its watershed is almost entirely within the Olympic National Park. What that means is that three-quarters of the watershed are permanently protected. They've always been beautiful. They always will be beautiful. The problem has been in the lower and middle reaches of the river, where two dams were built beginning in 1910. Before those dams were built, the river was home to all five species of Pacific salmon. There wasn't a season of the year when there wasn't a fish of some variety, either swimming upriver in its migration to its spawning grounds or coming downriver headed out to sea. You're talking about tens and tens of thousands of fish. Not only that, but the single largest species of Puget Sound Chinook, the Elwha Tai. These fish, if they could be left alone to live out their entire seven seasons in the ocean, could live to be even as large as 100 pounds. So you're talking about a truly special place, a river with abundant fish runs of every species that we see in the North Pacific. And these fish sustained the lower Elwha Klallam tribe, a Native American tribe that always had its homeland in the Elwha, living in villages along the Strait of Juan de Fuca and up and down the Elwha River, some 32 villages in all.
Would you say more about how salmon contributed to the Elwha ecosystem?
Well, you know, they sustained not only the native people, but all of the native animals and plants. People forget about that piece of the picture. You know, the Elwha isn't just a fish story. It's an ecosystem story. The salmon really are the keystone species for that entire ecosystem. And they feed not only the big things that we think about, like bears and eagles, but even the tiny little things in the benthos of the river. The benthos, that's the bottom. That's where all the little tiny things live that get the whole food chain started. Insects. And those little insects, well, they feed other fish. And those little fish, they feed the birds. And on it goes into the whole food chain. And it all starts with the fish. Not only that, but those fish, when they rot as carcasses along the sides of the river, the bears will drag them back into the forest. So will fishers and marten and otters. And those carcasses, they'll feed the trees. It's actually possible to see the signature of marine-derived nutrients, food from the sea, in the molecular structure of trees, of plants, even of songbirds that have maybe eaten an insect that dined on a salmon carcass. So you're talking about an animal in salmon that feeds a whole ecosystem of plants and animals, not only in the river itself, but in the watershed way beyond it.
Would you remind us of why the dams were built in the first place?
You know, it's easy to hate the Elwha dams because you think to yourself, how could anyone have done that? Well, it's important to remember a couple of things. Number one, how early in our history they were built. The first one was built in 1910. The second one, 1926. If you're from the East Coast, that doesn't sound like a long time ago. But out here in the Pacific Northwest, that's when things were just getting started in terms of white settlement and industrialization. So while the tribes had always lived out since time immemorial in this region, White people, settlers, began to come to Port Angeles in about the 1860s, 1870s, and mostly what they found were lots of trees. And there was this hunger for industrialization, for industry, for jobs, for really making money from the abundance of the natural wealth that was there. And there was a man named Thomas Aldwell, actually a Canadian, who arrived in Port Angeles in 1910, seeking to make his fortune like lots of other people at that time. So he looked around, and here's what he saw. A natural deep water port sheltered by the Eddis Hook, lots and lots of timber. And he figured out that if he could buy the land along the Elwha River, he could turn that deep water port and all those trees into lots of money by adding one thing, cheap power, hydropower. And he did it. He secretly bought up this land so that no one else could raise the price. And once he had attained all of the acreage he needed, he built Elwha Dam beginning in 1910. And you know what? He did it illegally. Even then, you had to provide a fishway wherever fish were wont to ascend. That is the actual wording, even from the territorial legislature before Washington was a state. But he worked a deal with the fisheries commissioner in which his little structure was regarded as an obstruction for a hatchery, thereby trading a hatchery for the wild ecosystem, something we've been doing ever since. And he built his dam, and he created cheap power. And by doing that, sparked the mill industry that would power the Olympic Peninsula and Port Angeles for generations to come.
How did building of the dams alter the ecosystem around the Elwha?
Well, you know, dams have a very profound effect on rivers in several ways. They alter things absolutely and completely. Here's what happens. When you obstruct the passage of fish coming back in their migratory pathway to the upper watershed, they suddenly are confined to a much smaller reach of the river. In the Elwha, the lower dam was built just 5 miles from the river mouth. So that meant these animals, instead of having access to the entire watershed, suddenly had access only to a tiny piece of it. They lost 70 miles of spawning habitat within the Elwha once that dam was built. And it wasn't only their ability to move into the upper watershed that they needed. Building that dam also meant that all of that gravel, sediment, silt, sand that would naturally be rinsing down from the mountains, all of that material, it's critical for salmon because that's the material in which they build their nests. They're called reds. And if a salmon doesn't have that material, it can't build the nests it needs in which to lay its eggs for the next generation. All of that material, it was trapped behind the dams, building up year by year in really a mountain, a delta of mud behind the wall of the dam instead of rinsing down into the river. And it affects not only the salmon, but even the structure of the river itself. When that material is trapped behind the dam, it's not available for the river to do its work, its natural construction work of building riffles and channels and pools. Rivers are always busy. They're never still, and they're never the same, but they need their own material to work with. And when it's starved for that material, the river becomes more simplified, less complex, less of a habitat for all of the things that live there. And there's one more thing. When you block the flow of the river and you create reservoirs, you also raise the water temperature because, of course, the sun heats those lakes behind the dam. Not only that, but there was always a pool below the Elwha Dam because that dam, you know, it leaked. It always leaked at least a little bit. And that pool in front of the dam, it would fill with water. And when the salmon came back for their migration in August, that water would get very, very warm because of the reservoir. So warm that it could even breed disease. And there would be years when the Lower Elwha Klallam tribe and the Department of Fish and Wildlife would have to actually rescue those returning fish. Because if they didn't take them out of the water and spawn them in a hatchery, they would lose the entire run because of disease. There's an amazing picture in my book, Elwha River Reborn, which was published this spring, of all of these gigantic Chinook salmon stacked in a freezer. These are fish that were killed by disease in the Elwha River because of this raised temperature, because of the dams. And so dams affect the ecosystem profoundly. They block migration of animals, raises water temperature, and it makes the dam block also the flow of sediment downstream that the river needs and fish need.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Linda Mapes, a staff reporter for the Seattle Times and author of the book, Elwha, A River Reborn, with photography by Steve Ringman. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. So now the dams are coming down. How far along is the dam removal project?
Well, it's a very exciting time in Washington State. Washington presently is home to the three largest dam removal projects ever in the history of the world. The very biggest are the two going on right now on Elwha River. The lower dam is completely gone. It's been gone since the spring of 2012. It's amazing how fast it happened. Contractors started in September 2011, and they had the lower dam, completely out by March of 2012. You go there today, it's like it never happened. It's like it was never there at all. It's just a bare hill. And the river is racing past the former dam site. It's very exciting to see. Now, Glynn's Canyon Dam, that's about 8 miles upriver, river mile 14.6. It's about two-thirds gone. That dam was 210 feet tall. Today, there are about 60 feet of that dam remaining, yet to come out. It will be taken out completely to make the river entirely free-flowing once again. Today, both reservoirs are gone. The river is free-flowing, but there is still that blockage to fish at the Glynn's Canyon Dam site. Dam removal is actually presently on hold, and it will resume, but right now there's no dam removal going on because of a problem with a water plant downstream. This is a water plant that was built as part of the project, the dam removal project, but it's not working properly. It's supposed to take sediment out of the water to pre-treat it for use by industrial users downstream. However, it clogged. It clogged in the first fall rains in 2013. And so there are a lot of contractors there trying to figure out what the problem is and how to fix it. Once they get it fixed, dam removal will resume.
What is the timeline for removal at this point?
Well, it's a bit of a mystery. The contract is supposed to be completed by September of this year. However, it's possible that work won't be done by then, so they might have to extend it. If you ask some scientists, they tell you it's most likely dam removal won't begin again until even next winter. But nobody really knows for sure. Depends on how long it takes to fix the water plant. But no one's talking about walking away from Elwha Dam removal. If it isn't finished this spring, it'll be finished next winter. If it's not finished next winter, it'll be finished next spring. It's going to happen. And this was mandated by Congress, and it's been supported broadly by the American people, and it's going to happen. It's just taking longer than people wanted.
Would you say more about the issues with the sediment that had been stored behind the dam?
You know, I remember when I first started covering this story and telling my editor I wanted to write a sediment story. And he said, oh, great, that sounds really interesting. But actually, as he and so many other people have come to see, it actually is fascinating. I mean, it's what makes the Elwha Dam project so unique. There's never been an effort to manage this much sediment in a dam removal project. So how much sediment am I talking about? 34 million cubic yards. Now, if you want to try to imagine just how much material that is, it's enough to fill 5 or 6 Safeco fields all the way to the top. It's a fantastic amount of silt, sand, gravel, rocks. And all of this stuff has got to be safely released from behind the dams. You can't just blow out the dams and let all that material come rushing down river. You'd bury the communities downstream. You'd have an incredible avalanche of mud, and that's just not safe or acceptable. Not only that, but most of this is going on within a national park. And so you want a landscape left behind that doesn't look like a moonscape. And so the plan is to take the dams down gradually, 10 feet at a time, and let the river do the work of gradually eroding that material out to sea. So what's left behind are these gentle, stepped down terraces in the valley walls. And most of the material, 60% of it, will be distributed throughout the length of the river and rinsed all the way out to salt water. About 40% of it will remain behind in the watershed.
Well, you mentioned that the sediment had clogged the water plant, but what else has happened with the sediment as it's been released?
Well, what's so exciting is it's starting to rebuild the beaches. Now, these beaches at the mouth of the Elwha River, 2 summers ago, they would have turned your ankle. Nothing but rocks, big, bare cobble. which is not the way they're supposed to be. If you talk to elders in the Lower Elwha-Kalam tribe, they will tell you stories about how their grandparents used to watch for the big clouds of seagulls after a storm. That told them it was time to take their basket and go to the beach, because it meant that the wind had kicked up the waves and the waves had brought in a harvest of clams. Now, when you're standing there on that rocky, eroded beach, you think, clams, I can't even imagine it. But if you go to the beach today at the Elwha River, you can understand what those old people were talking about, because it's soft and it's sandy once more. Not only that, but there's a delta building up at the mouth of the river like it's supposed to be. The near shore is starting to look more natural. It's starting to look more like it does in the old photographs and in the stories of the elders who remember the river back when it was healthy.
How have the geologic changes affected the habitat for plants and animals?
You know, it's exciting because when you go out and you look at the lower dam area where it used to be a dam, what you see today are the footprints, the tracks of all kinds of animals using this area once again. When the reservoirs flooded out that bottom land, elk and other animals lost 800 acres of habitat that's been returned to them. This is a critical place for these upland animals. They use it during the winter time so that they can be out of the colder upper reaches of the watershed. They come down to these more sheltered, warmer places. And if you go to that former lake bottom today, you also see the tracks of otters and marten and all kinds of birds. Animals are already using this place again. Not only that, but the fish. The fish have already found their way back to side channels of the river, which are nice, quieter places. The water's warmer, it's not so full of sediment. And they're using these places for spawning already, even though we haven't yet attained the full 70 miles of habitat that ultimately will be returned to the fish. There's still a lot that's been opened up for them all the way up to the foot of Glynne's Canyon Dam, including side channel habitat. And fish are back, animals are coming back. It's a very exciting thing to see.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Linda Mapes, a staff reporter for the Seattle Times and author of the book Elwha, A River Reborn, with photography by Steve Ringman. What are the stated restoration goals for the Elwha ecosystem?
This is the thing that makes the Elwha so unique. It's not just a restoration of a fish run. It's a restoration of an entire place. This is a truly mountains-to-sea scale restoration. That's the thing I always like to stress, is the scale of this. We really won't see anything else like this in our lifetime, where with one action you restore 70 miles of spawning habitat for fish, and you change the whole nutrient cycle of an entire watershed. We're talking about 326 square miles, most of it already protected within Olympic National Park, which means once you take out those dams, you bring back the fish, which feed a whole suite of animal life, some 83 species, everything from little tiny insects and birds to garter snakes to bears, all sorts of animals that depend on these fish for their diet. Those animals are all going to come back. Eagles, you don't see them above what used to be the upper dam today because there's nothing for them to eat, but they're going to be coming back. So that's the thing about the Elwha to keep in mind. It's not just a fish story. It's a whole ecosystem restoration. And when Congress passed the Elwha Restoration Act in 1992, it's called the Elwha Fisheries and Ecosystem Restoration Act. It was intended from the very beginning to do more than just bring back the fish. That's a big deal, of course. This was a legendary place for fishermen, and the fish runs there are really, truly so potentially big and important they could help boost the productivity of all of Puget Sound. But it's also an entire ecosystem story.
You mentioned wildlife coming back, but how about plant life?
This is a really interesting piece of the Elwha restoration. Remember that 800 acres I talked about? These are these two former reservoirs. Well, now that they're drained, you should see what it looks like. It's 800 acres of blowing sand, sediment, cobble, rock. You know, if we don't do something, that's going to turn into blackberry and scotch broom and other weeds. Within 150 feet of the native forest, there'll be a rain of seeds coming from the forest itself that will naturally revegetate that place with native plants, shrubs, trees. But what about the rest of that territory? How are we going to keep it from just turning into a big weed patch? Well, the Olympic National Park, several years ago, began gathering, with the work of some volunteers, seeds of native plants in the Elwha watershed so that these would be the right plants for the right place. And they began growing those plants in a greenhouse out near Port Angeles. And now they're starting to plant those plants. Live stakes, transplants, and even seeds, thousands and thousands of seeds that they're scattering over this watershed. This is a 6-year revegetation effort. It's absolutely unprecedented. There's never been anything like it. Imagine trying to grow plants in this material. No compost, very little soil, can't water it. The area is too big. How's it going to work? This is very much an experiment. I wonder how many of these plants will survive snacking by those elk coming back. And so far, there has been the problem with weeds. Reed canary grass is a terrible invader. The Park Service has already had to spray to try to get rid of that. But there have been good surprises, too. They were surprised by how much cottonwood seed the river had pushed along and it has sprouted. There's been a lot of legacy moisture in those former lake beds that's helped those trees grow on. The question is how long they'll live as the lake beds dry out now that they're no longer lakes. So, again, this is something the world has never seen before. It's not even like the revegetation after Mount St. Helens. This, in some ways, is harder. Mount St. Helens, that was a layer of ash on top of a legacy of all sorts of seeds and roots and even plants. This is more like starting over after the retreat of a glacier. You're talking about anoxic material. It's not soil. It doesn't have any of the usual properties of soil with pore space and nutrients. It's more like powder. When you feel it, it's very fine. So growing anything in, say, 5 feet of fines, that's not something you see in nature. And we'll just have to see how it goes.
How has dam removal affected the lower Elwha Klallam tribe?
This is a beautiful thing. You know, the restoration of the Elwha is about more than plants and animals, fish. It's also about people. The Lower Elwha Klallam tribe has already had some very important things happen since this dam removal began. When the Elwha Dam came out, that, of course, eliminated the reservoir. And what had been hidden under that reservoir, drowned for a century, was the tribe's creation site. This is a place in the rocks. It's a depression, a little bit of a pool. And the tribe, according to its teachings, believed that is its creation site, where its people came to be. The creator brought the Elwha Klallam tribe from this place. And, you know, nobody in the tribe today had seen it because they had only heard about it. It had been drowned and lost to them for a century. But once the waters receded, it was rediscovered. And the tribe has made several trips out there to see it. This was a great joy, you know, for people who had only heard about this place and even themselves wondered if it really existed, to be able to go there themselves and put their hands in the water in that pool as their ancestors had done. That was very, very important. There have also been village sites and camps discovered, and it's not a surprise. They knew that their people used this landscape all the way up and down the river, but it's been a great joy to stand where their ancestors stood once again and see those places, have them come back. Of course, the return of the fish is critically important to the tribe. So much of everything they do depends on those fish and always did. So that's a huge victory, really. The tribe was one of the first to push for dam removal beginning back in the 1980s with a lawsuit against the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And they were joined by environmental groups throughout Washington state to not just do so-called mitigation for relicensing these dams, but actually take them out.
There have been conflicts about using hatchery fish in Elwha restoration versus just letting the wild fish repopulate the area. Where does this issue currently stand?
That's the single most controversial piece of the Elwha restoration. It was a great disappointment to scientists and a lot of native fish advocates and people that the Elwha couldn't be a living laboratory, a place where you would get to see native fish naturally recolonize a wild place. There were reasons why that didn't happen. Some of them were just pure impatience. People didn't want to wait the possibly 20 years it might take for abundance to naturally return to the river. Secondly, while the river is a living laboratory, it's also the homeland of the Lower Oaklallam tribe, and they didn't want to wait 20 years for restoration of fish runs either. They want to be able to fish, and just because we suddenly cared about the river after giving up on it for 100 years, they didn't want to necessarily do things on our timetable. And so there was a desire to try to get the river so-called jump-started. And, you know, while you'll hear some scientists say, well, the Elwha is not a dead battery, it's a living river, and if you just leave it alone, it'll do its job. There were others who believed that because of tribal treaty rights and also the need to protect very fragile, endangered fish runs during this high sediment time, that you'd need a hatchery, both to jumpstart the river without planted fish and also provide a safe haven for runs of fish that were down to such small numbers there was concern you could actually lose them as all this sediment is released during dam removal. The very, very controversial piece of this was the idea of the tribes to plant non-native steelhead in the river so that they would have something to catch that's not listed on the Endangered Species Act right away. There is a 5-year moratorium on catching anything in the river during dam removal, but after that moratorium, they wanted something to catch, and they figured these non-native Chambers Creek steelhead would be the thing to catch. Well, that brought such an outcry from so many scientists and so many native fish advocates that the tribe decided not to do that. They have since completely backed away from that plan. They actually got rid of the non-native steelhead that were at the hatchery. They either outplanted them to a lake with no outlet to the river or just flat out destroyed them. So there will be no non-native fish planted in the river from the hatchery. The hatchery is being used to plant coho and chinook in the river in some of the side channels. That's been going on since dam removal started, and it will continue. And the hatchery is also being used to try to raise up populations of pinks. Everyone talks about Chinook. Pink are actually very, very important salmon in the Elwha. These are the fish that used to storm the river just by the hundreds of thousands. They're the biomass that are going to feed the entire ecosystem. And so it's hoped that pinks, which are now functionally extinct in the river, will once again return. Maybe even sockeye. They are hoped to stray into the river and repopulate. So maybe there'll even be a sockeye run in the Elwha.
Would you like to tell us about the upcoming exhibit?
Yes, this is very exciting. The Burke Museum of Natural History and Culture here in Seattle is going to be opening a major exhibit on the Elwha and its restoration in the Lower Oaklallam Tribe. The exhibit will open in November, Thanksgiving week, and it'll be up all the way through March. Then it's going to travel across Washington State and then travel across the country, bringing the story of the Elwha restoration to millions of people.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would encourage people to keep following this story. It's just beginning. This is year two of a story that's going to be unfolding over our lifetimes. We've got one dam out, one more still to go. Just the beginnings of some of the most incredible changes that we've ever seen in an ecological restoration. I would encourage people to come and see it for themselves. It's public land, it's open access, don't need a permit of any kind, and I would encourage them to keep reading about it. I'm still covering it at seattletimes.com. You can go online and read my stuff there. And Elwha, A River Reborn, my book just out from the Mountaineers, tells you the whole story, puts it in a historic context, and tells you everything from the politics involved to make it happen to some of the ecological changes already underway. I would say stay with the story because there's really nothing else like it.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Linda.
Thank you.
You are just listening to Linda Mapes, a staff reporter for the Seattle Times and author of the book Elwha, A River Reborn, with photography by Steve Ringman, co-published in 2013 by the Mountaineers Books and the Seattle Times. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.